Okay, at last here. Any preliminary issues or questions? Okay, we left off last time having completed the part dealing with emotional harm and the whole notion of compensatory damages. We now shift to the topic of punitive awards. Under what circumstances should a jury have the assignment not simply to provide compensation to the plaintiff, but to exercise a kind of public policy function of punishing the defendant? And assuming we do give the jury such authority, by what standards should they assess the award? So the first case we have here is Moran versus Johns Manville. Can somebody tell me about Mr. Moran? Mr. Griffin. The Latin form for a male ends in O-R. So when you have a female serving in that function, the executor or the, trying to think what other, testator, when it's a female version of it, you add the I-X. So executrix would be a female executor. Anyway, okay, go ahead. Yeah. Okay, so the issue on appeal is, should the trial judge have allowed the jury to make a punitive award? And the defendant has a couple of arguments as to why they shouldn't have been allowed to do that. Tell me again what those arguments are. I'm sorry, what was the first one? Okay, but with respect to the award of punitive damages, why shouldn't we give punitive damages to the plaintiff in this case? Okay. All right. That's the court's response. But just in terms of characterizing the defendant's arguments, one of the defendant's arguments is that the plaintiff didn't meet the standard for awarding punitive damages. What is the defendant's version of the standard for awarding punitive damages? Yeah. And in fact, the traditional standard for punitive damages is that the distinction between a compensatory award and a punitive award is if the injury occurs through inadvertence, through negligence, it was an accident, maybe an accident caused by lack of care on the part of the defendant, but it's merely negligent, then that is a case that justifies a compensatory award. But to make an award of punitive damages to punish the defendant, you have to show something more than merely negligent conduct. You have to show some kind of spite or ill will or malicious motivation. And the defendant points to the record and says that with respect to Mr. Moran, at least, there was nothing personal here. They weren't certainly weren't trying to single Mr. Moran or any other user of this product out to try to hurt him. So on what basis can we say, so argues the defendant, that there's anything here to justify the award of punitive damages? What's the court's response to that argument? Okay. Okay, and just before we get to the facts of this particular case, the court says that this standard of malice can be met essentially in two ways. One is by showing there's some kind of express malice, that the defendant is seeking to harm. There is something personal here between the defendant and the plaintiff. That's one way to show it. But the other way to show it is through this implied malice, which is satisfied by this kind of reckless indifference. If I drive 70 miles an hour past a school zone while kids are going to and from school, it may be true that I have no desire to harm any of those children, but if I behave in such a flagrantly indifferent fashion, knowing of this risk, I proceed to put other people in harm's way solely to accomplish some desire of my own, that kind of flagrant or reckless indifference can satisfy this standard by being a kind of implied malice. Only a person of sort of depraved sensibility would behave in this way. Now, with respect to Johns Manville, what is the evidence that they behaved with flagrant or reckless indifference? Okay. And this sort of sets up the issue we come back to in a couple of subsequent cases, which is exactly where is that line drawn between lack of reasonable care, failing to meet the standard of a reasonably prudent person, and this much worse categorization of implied malice. If my example of driving 70 miles an hour past a school zone where kids are going, across the street and riding their bicycles and so forth, if that would seem like a form of reckless indifference, where does the line get drawn between going 15 miles an hour, which is the speed limit in a school, or 20 miles an hour, let's say it's a speed limit in a school zone, 23 miles an hour may be negligent, 30, 35, do I hear 40? At what point do we cross over from merely negligent conduct to something that is flagrantly indifferent? Do manufacturers learn about potential problems with their products? If you're Dow Corning and you hear reports that women who've used your breast implants have had subsequent health problems, What do you do with that information? If you may think that the reports are exaggerated, or you know the scientific evidence is not in yet completely, do you hold a press conference to say, gee, here are all the reports about people who've had problems after using our product? Or do you sort of, you know, hope that there will be more reliable scientific data later on that will vindicate the safety of your product? Again, you know, if you're Ford Explorer or you're Bridgestone Tires or you're, you know, the manufacturer of all kinds of other different products where there are reports of problems, how do you identify what a reasonable person would do and then differentiate what a recklessly indifferent, depraved person would do? Johns Manville is saying, in effect, we're on this side of that line. And the court says, no, you're not. You're in that zone where a jury could find that your behavior was flagrantly indifferent, recklessly indifferent, and you now have to pay not merely compensation, but whatever the jury decides is fit punishment. Now, John Manville raises another argument as to why they shouldn't pay punitive damages in this case, and what's that? Well, yeah, okay, but I think you mentioned another one as to why, as a public policy matter, we shouldn't be awarding. Go ahead. Well, I think there's an additional, in addition to looking at whether this legal standard had been met, Johns Manville might say, well, maybe this case taken in isolation would justify the award of punitive damages, but seeing this case in context, there is a reason why we shouldn't give punitive damages to this guy. Well, if they deserve to pay lots of other people, maybe we should open the gates. Ms. DeRosier? Okay, that's one argument. We don't deserve, at least here I am, the manager of Johns Manville. You're accusing, you're essentially, or I'm a stockholder in Johns Manville. You're taking money out of my pocket based on what somebody did 20, 30 years ago. Now, what's the answer to that argument? What's that? But why is it fair that a stockholder today pays for the sins of what somebody did 30 years ago? Yeah, in the same way you buy stock, you know, if you buy stock in IBM and profit from all the good things they did 30 years ago, or Microsoft or whatever, you now, you take the bitter with the sweet, whatever. Whatever your company, whatever the company has done for good or for ill, is visited upon subsequent shareholders, employees, etc. So, and part of the rationale for punishing these people even at this late date is to say, in effect, as you decide where to invest your money or where you're going to go to work, you should take into account what is the likelihood that the place where I'm working has good sort of ethical boundaries, or am I going to work for WorldCom where people say, well, maybe it's a capital expense, I mean, maybe it's an operating expense, but if we call it a capital asset, our stock price will go up. Okay. To the extent that you then visit the consequences of that kind of decision making on the people who work there and the stockholders who you give the stockholders and the employees an incentive to say, no, there goes my 401k plan if you do stuff like that, because we're going to have to pay the consequences for it. Whereas if you say, in effect, so long as you keep it hidden for long enough, we won't make the people who are your successors pay for it, then you have a sort of an incentive to do things so long as you can get away with them for a period of time. But there's another argument, aside from the fairness of imposing it on these. Ms. Russell? And again, just to be clear about the difference between this argument and the one we were just discussing, it's not so much that it would be unfair to Johns Manville to destroy it, but, for example, the future claimants. Mr. Moran may be not the first, but there may be people coming after him whose disease manifests itself at a subsequent date, and when they show up to be compensated as Mr. Moran wants to be compensated, if Mr. Moran has already cleaned out the till, collecting these punitive damages, the people behind him in line won't even get compensated. So Johns Manville says, in effect, before you award punitive damages, you should make sure that people who have compensatory damages claims have their day in court. And as you point out, the court's response to that, it's actually an interesting argument. For the first time, Johns Manville is making an argument about people other than their stockholders and their employees, but about third parties, plaintiffs like Mr. Moran, who weren't as quick to file their claim. And the argument has some plausibility, but again, the court's response to that was, yeah, go down to the legislature. You might have a point here. There may be some merit to your argument, but we as a court can't begin to try to shuffle all these things. It's for the legislature to deal with. Now, the whole issue about awarding punitive damages has been a relatively hot topic in terms of legislative reform. Many corporate leaders look at these punitive damage awards, and in the BMW case that we'll look at down the road, as sort of the worst example of inappropriate litigation. That is, instead of getting compensation to people who need it, you're just making lawyers and enterprising plaintiffs rich with awards that aren't connected to any kind of real damage. And some legislatures have been receptive to that argument. And although punitive damage awards are relatively infrequent, they get the attention of corporate leaders, in part because these kinds of awards are not insurable. You can't insure against punitive awards. You can insure against compensatory awards. And while corporations are concerned, many of them are self-insured or they pay the cost of insurance, the punitive awards come more directly out of their bottom line and are typically assessed sort of on a personal level. So the people who are involved and get sued for punitive damages feel more of a stake in it. Now, again, the merits of whether these punitive awards are good or bad, as you'll see in the BMW case, and the role of the courts in kind of protecting defendants from excessive punitive awards, that is itself a fairly controversial issue. where some people, again, think that this system has run amok and is doing more harm than good. Other people look to punitive awards against corporations as one of the primary methods of deterring the otherwise irresistible urge to make a quick buck, regardless of the means that must be taken to do so. So again, Moran's kind of the opening scene in this drama. Let's look at Grimshaw, another case of compensatory and punitive damages, and a case fairly well known. Can somebody tell me about Grimshaw? Yes, Mr. Herbert Holtz. Okay. Okay, I think one of the striking things about the Pinto case is the way in which the behavior of the defendant is well documented. That what you or I do in our day-to-day decision-making process, when we, you know, are in a hurry, and yeah, there is that school zone, and I'm going 45 when the speed limit is really 20, but the traffic with me is going 35, and hey, it's not that big a deal. Those sorts of things go on in our heads, whereas Ford's decision-making process is excruciatingly well documented in the form of memos going back and forth. I'm, for some reason, reminded of Winston Churchill's growing up. If you haven't already done so, you should consider reading the biography by William Manchester, the historian. There should be a third volume, but I don't know that the third volume will ever be written. But there are two pretty long first volumes of the life of Churchill. And as you may know, his father was a rather prominent Tory politician, and his wife was American, actually. Jenny, I think, was her name. They sent him off to boarding school, and you know, Winston Churchill was not exactly this dashing figure. He was a rather plain-looking child. Goes off to boarding school and does not have a particularly fun time at boarding school. Looks forward to coming home for the holidays. But his mother tended to prefer the French Riviera and not having children underfoot. And so he would write these letters begging his mother, you know, oh, please, you know, let me come home this Christmas. And she'd write back, you know, gee, I wish I could do this, but, you know, I've already made these plans, and it's just, I mean, by all rights, Winston Churchill should have been a psychopath. Because, you know, it's just this absolutely heart-wrenching pleading. So what brought that to mind is in addition to my deteriorating mental condition, the fact that you have this dialogue between engineering and sales here, where engineering is gets the crash test reports, and it's not looking too good. You know, at pretty low speed, this the integrity of this fuel tank it ain't happening. And they want to do, they have all kinds of different ideas. We could strengthen this. We could put these, different pieces of metal in. We could just put in this nylon liner, ladder as they call it, inside the gas tank. So even if the gas tank gets crushed, there's the likelihood that this liner would contain the gasoline and keep it from spilling out and igniting. And sales says, in effect, no. We've got a budget, we've got a time schedule, all the stuff you're talking about costs us time and money we simply don't have if we're going to produce this car at a price point that's going to catch on in the market. We can't do what you're asking us to do. And so the car gets shipped. Now, Ford's response to this case is, in effect, the John Lovett response, is that so wrong? What differentiates this decision from all the other decisions that go into making an automobile? You have all sorts of ideas of what you could do. I could put in this navigation system, and I could put in airbags, and I could have this, system for courtesy lights in the back, and I could do these things for whatever, and the budget just doesn't permit it. Why is this so different? What's going on in this case that makes it not just a case where you didn't do a reasonably good job designing this car, you deserve to be punished to the tune, and again, the award, the compensatory award here was, what? $2.5 million for a very serious burn injury, and then the punitive award here is $125 million. There's a decimal point here. What justifies the jury in getting so irate about this, Mr. Beauvais? But let's talk about that for a second. The federal standards were ones that were going to apply in a future model year. They did these tests sort of out of curiosity to see, okay, when those new standards apply, how well will this design fare? But the federal standards didn't apply to them yet. So would they have been better off if they hadn't tested the car? Are they more sort of like ignorance of the law here, are they worse off because they actually went ahead and tested this thing than if they hadn't tested it at all and didn't know how dangerous it was? Would that have made them liable only for compensatory damages? But since they went ahead and did the test, now we get to punish them? Mr. Stubbs? And as John Lovett would say, is that so wrong? What's so bad about, in fact, who tells us we ought to do that kind of comparison? Our old friend Learned Hand. He's saying that's what reasonable people do. Reasonable people estimate what's the downside risk here, what's the damage, multiplied by the probability, and it turns out Ford has pretty good statistics on two of those three variables. They have pretty good statistics on the likelihood of this kind of collision, the probability, and they have good statistics on the burden. The one thing you can question about their equation is the use of a figure for the magnitude of the loss. What was the figure they used for the magnitude of the loss? $200,000. Where'd they get that? Jury verdicts. They went out and, you know, just did a little research on what the average award was for a, you know, a wrongful death case, and the figure they came back with was $200,000. Would you feel better about Ford if they made it $400,000 instead of $200,000? Or is it the use of the formula itself? Again, this sort of takes us back to our initial discussion about Learned Hand, which was the one that I did on tape, so we didn't have a chance to kind of roll it around a little bit, but the whole question about the use of this kind of explicit comparison, now that the Ford engineers are doing it, we find that juries are horrified. Should they be horrified? Should we tell the jury your reaction is irrational? Or should we revisit Learned Hand and say, wow, what were we thinking? Or what? What's I'm kind of lost here. What's happened to our decision-making process, and what is the place of this kind of comparison? Is there a place for this kind of comparison? And to try to put it sympathetically on behalf of the engineers, you know, the engineers, or for that matter, you know, the vice presidents who read their memos, their question to us is, in effect, what would you have me do? How am I supposed to design a fuel tank system? By what criteria? I'm also sort of in a movie mode here. If you've seen Marathon Man with Dustin Hoffman and Laurence Olivier is the sadistic dentist. Who was Dr. Weiss? Anyway, this Nazi criminal who's escaped with all his money. Anyway, he has Dustin Hoffman in the chair with his dental equipment, you know, wedged up into his nerves, his dental nerves, and he's saying, "Is it safe?" the engineer wants to know, "Is it safe? By what criteria here do we judge whether the car is reasonably safe or not?" And it would be one thing if we told Ford, "Hey, you made a mistake. You didn't do this well enough. You have to pay the damages." But now we're telling Ford, "You are such rotten human beings. We want to punish you." Mr. Stubbs. Okay, so it could be that if Learned Hand were, you know, resurrected and we were able to question him about this, he would tell us, "Oh, no, I was only talking about cargoes of flour. I never meant for this to be applied to human life." Well, remember the... remember Levi versus Slemko, the electric case? They did apply the Learned Hand formula to a guy who gets hurt. I can't remember whether he survives or not, but he gets badly hurt by contacting this electric wire, and they apply the Learned Hand formula. Mr. Jones?
I think to me it's kind of
Okay. I'm trying to get sort of the timing issue. In other words, if they had done this sort of on the back of an envelope, and then after the car was out there in circulation, they were trying to figure out, should we recall the car? That they might have said, well, you know, it wasn't the best design, but now that it's out there, let's sort of let sleeping dogs lie. It's not worth, you know, issuing some big, huge recall and trying to retrofit them. But do we have anything? It seems to me what we're telling Ford, in effect, is don't even think this way. And I guess my response on Ford's behalf is, well, how are we supposed to think? I mean, it would be nice if I worked at Mercedes, you know, and my budget for every car was essentially, hey, you know, don't worry about the cost, just make it the best car you can make. But I don't work at Mercedes. I'm making Pintos. So, you know, money is an object here, and you're telling me I'm not supposed to think about that, or I'm sort of confused here. Ms. Stryker? But I'm not disagreeing with your point, but I want to be difficult here, which is to say, isn't it true of car manufacturing in general that if you make a million cars, you know that a certain percentage of the people that use your cars are going to die in rollover accidents or in, you know, collisions with trees or with, you know, things are going to happen, even in a Mercedes, I would imagine. They have, you know, some people, well, in fact, you know, Princess Diana dies in a Mercedes, partly because she's not wearing her seatbelt, but, you know, bad things do happen even in those kind of cars. And so the question would be, is there a difference between being a car manufacturer where you know a certain percentage of people will die? And then you figure, okay, do we put in side impact airbags? Do we put it in just in our high-end cars? Do we put it in all our cars? And again, going back to chapter one, I would say this is in part where we revert to a sort of intuitive standard. We no longer do a cost-benefit analysis. We just sort of know intuitively, well, gee, if I'm making this kind of a car, it doesn't make sense to put in side impact airbags. But if I'm making that kind of a car, it does make sense. I mean, in part because what'll sell? I mean, if I make a Honda Civic and it costs $30,000, people aren't going to buy it. If I make a, you know, Lincoln Navigator, and it costs $35,000, people will buy it. And one of the reasons they might buy it is because it's got all these nifty features in it. And again, I think Ford could sort of say, look, I'm just responding to the marketplace. Don't blame me. Hey, if people would pay the extra money for us to put in all these safety features, engineering's chomping at the bit. They'd love to do it. But it's the consumer that decides, in effect, whether this car is going to have an airbag, because the consumer decides whether they'll pay the extra money that it costs to put one in. And our judgment was, and excuse me if I made the wrong decision, but my judgment was that people would rather have a Pinto that they could make the monthly payments on, even if the risk was, every once in a while, it's not pretty. Mr. Gordon? Okay.
They don't give them an option in the showroom and say, well, you can get a note for this price, it's a good car, you know, but if you want to upgrade to this other vehicle, you have a better gas tank, it's not going to explode on your right.
Okay. But I got a lot of these Pintos in stock here, and I can make it real good. Well, I think the whole idea about, you know, the what's going on with the Pinto is not so much we're shocked, really shocked at the fact that they trade off potential safety for keeping the cost minimal. There is a kind of non-disclosure here. There's a sort of fraud going on that I think is partly what got the jury so irate, that when you buy the Pinto, in part because Ford had been downsizing their vehicle fleet. So, you know, ironically, the car that rear-ends the Pinto is a Ford Galaxy. So you're used to driving around in these big American cars. You know, we get the oil embargo and the rise in gasoline prices and the flood of imported high fuel economy cars, and suddenly Detroit is desperate to get these more economical cars on the marketplace, but people are sort of assuming that because they're made by Detroit, they will have the same features as their old, you know, Ford Galaxy. And so if, as you say, Ford had provided a little disclaimer, one of the features of this car is that it's lightweight, you know, has high fuel economy, et cetera, but if you really want the best car in terms of safety, I mean, there are ways you could describe it that says instead of, yeah, it's cheap, but it's a you know, death trap, you know, you could do some kind of disclosure that would, but even at that, I'm not sure the jury would have accepted even that. Mr. Lawley. Well, again, the sort of the raw confrontation, the unbuffered confrontation between sort of the profit motive and human life, I think is the part that the jury found distasteful and unacceptable. I mean, this is where we'll talk later on about the way in which one of the things that plaintiffs' lawyers want to do, whether the case is explicitly about punitive damages or not, is a plaintiff's lawyer wants the jury to feel that in their verdict they are sending a message, that they are, in effect, readjusting the general sense of the importance of human safety and that we are a better society for having essentially spoken out against this particular kind of abuse. Now, there's a strong kind of punitive flavor to that. We'll talk about that at the very end of the chapter. But I do think that there's something there about the jury wanting to sort of reaffirm its values, and behavior like this is very threatening to the idea but on the other hand, as Mr. Gordon was saying, if you sit on the board of directors of a corporation, you may feel your primary responsibility is to make money for your stockholders. And it's up to people like the government. Again, Ford, I don't want to, I'm playing almost literally the devil's advocate here to sort of try to paint Ford in a better light. Ford might have pointed to the government and said, look, if these cars really needed better crash protection, why did Congress delay the application of these standards until subsequent years? If you'd imposed this requirement on us, we would have met that. We knew how to meet it. But I guess Congress decided it wasn't important enough, or the National Highway Transportation Safety Administration decided it wasn't important enough to put it online now. This was something off in the future. So, you know, why are you getting all bent out of shape at us? Your elected representatives made a choice about this, and they didn't even have stockholders to answer to. Mr. Rubio? Oh, I mean, this is where, I mean, getting back to Mr. Gordon's point about what do you expect people to do on this, sitting on a board of directors, one of the things that you have to do in that capacity is to think long term. If you're on the board of directors at Ford or Bridgestone, you realize that, gee, if we blow this decision, we're going to be digging out from the bad PR for years. So let's not be, you know, penny wise and pound foolish, try to make an extra buck here, go slow on the recall of the tires until we're, you know, sitting in a congressional investigation and they're, you know, the headlines every day are about, you know, this corporate malfeasance. We don't want to be there. And so what you have to do is look at the short term, you know, bottom line, but also think, well, wait a minute. And I think the question Ford should have asked in this case, the engineers, the salespeople, the board of directors, who are these people? Would I want one of my kids driving around in this car? You know, if this car is safe enough so I'd put my kids in it cheerfully, fine. It's not a Mercedes, but hey, but if on the thought, I said, oh, not my kids. You know, those poor people who, as Leona Helmsley said about taxes, you know, taxes are for little people. You know, these Pinos, that's, my kids, I'm going to put them in the mid-range car here. I'm not going to put them in one of these things. Well, if that's your attitude, then you... The little alarm bell should go off in your head that sooner or later this is going to be on the front page of the paper. So balanced against the concern about the bottom line and dividends and earnings per share and all that kind of stuff, as important as it is, I mean, you'll be out of business if you don't pay attention to that. You have to ask the question, yeah, but can I go home and look myself in the mirror and would I be okay if people knew what I was really doing here? Would this withstand a kind of, you know, test of people of ordinary decency? Or would I be embarrassed to have people know what I'm doing? And if that's true, then it may have a short-term appeal. I mean, I keep coming back to WorldCom. Here are people at WorldCom who count expenditures as though they were capital assets. And, you know, how many people knew about that and sort of shrugged their shoulders and said, you know, seems a little slimy to me, but hey, I'm just, you know, I'm just the data entry person here, or I'm just the assistant treasurer and the comptroller has made this decision. And, you know, how many people just sort of assumed without recognizing, wait a minute, this is like basic fraud, and this whole company's going down if this is the way it operates. Mr. Gallard? Yeah.
And so you have a situation where you've got a no oil turn aspect in a way. I mean, the American public can't buy a lot of manufacturing.
Well, although ironically, by 1971, Detroit would think nostalgically of the day when the only cars Americans could buy were those that were made in Detroit. And as long as the people, you know, in the other factories there in Detroit were making the same kind of cars, we're all kind of working in the same club together. By that time, the influx of imported cars was such that, they had lost their monopoly. Although they still, again, I think there was this part of what made the Ford Pinto a problem was people did have this lingering sense of trust that American automobiles were sturdy, unlike, you know, if I buy one of those the old Renaults or you know the little Fiats, which were, you know, the lawnmower engines and, you know, piece of sheet metal with a little window in it, you know, I mean, you know what you're getting there, but sort of the assumption was if I'm buying an American-made car, it's a substantial piece of work. Yeah, exactly. So again, I think in this long reverie here about the what juries are thinking and what corporate executives should be thinking and anticipating juries. Rather than having corporate executives say these juries are just smoking something, I mean they're completely out of control. They're not living. Let's put restrictions on what juries can do so that they won't run away with things. Part of the message to the corporate leaders is, in effect, if you're so out of touch with ordinary decency that you do something like this, then maybe you deserve to get whacked. On the other hand, I do think that there's some difficulty in drawing that line. I mean, just sort of as a reality check. I mean, if the definition of liability for punitive damages is the conscious taking of a risk, not inadvertence, I, you know, made a left turn, I didn't see that guy coming, had my foot a little heavy on the gas, I didn't do the right thing there, but that was inadvertent. But when you consciously make a choice knowing that there's a risk and you take it anyway, that's what got Ford into trouble. How many people have ever consciously set the cruise control on their cars above the legal speed limit? Fair number of people, I would guess. Now, what's different between that and what Ford did? I mean, part of the difference, as Ms. Stryker was pointing out, is Ford's making millions of cars. It's not just the possibility. I set the cruise control with the expectation that nothing bad is going to happen. Ford designs a Pinto knowing that a certain number of people are going to die in their cars. I mean, even Mercedes makes their cars knowing that a certain number of people are going to die in their cars. So maybe that's a different phenomenon. But I'm sort of suggesting that it's not as bright a line as one might like between doing things and having some expectation that bad things might happen as a consequence. Okay, there are a few things. When we come back, I want to talk about sort of the more technical details of Grimshaw, and we'll talk about BMW and attorney's fees with the remaining hour. So we'll take a 10-minute break here.